Jitana, Reel 1. Can we start, please, by your telling me where you were born and something about your family background?
Oh, yes. Well, I was born at Taunton, Somerset, July 1914. My father was an electrical engineer, and I lived at Taunton until I was 10 years of age or thereabouts, when my people came to Bristol because of my dad having changed his job. At that stage, my grandma took me on board because I had won a scholarship to Taunton School from my initial first school, St. Andrew's Church School, Taunton. And therefore, on going to Taunton School, it was imperative I had to live locally as a day boarder, and did. My grandma living 2 miles outside of Taunton in a village called Staple Grove. And I stayed there with her. And from Taunton School, I later got a scholarship again on to Sandhurst. And at Sandhurst, I did, or rather prior to Sandhurst and at Taunton School, I did OTC. And then at Sandhurst, I got my commission straight and direct into the Indian Army on about just prior to my 20th birthday. I was 19 plus.
What did you think of the training that you got at Sandhurst?
Wonderful. Superb.
Why was that?
Because it was my first real introduction to real pukka soldiering. And since I was not having a wealthy background, I had to toe the line, so to speak. Yet within the limits of towing the line, i.e. to be in by 23:59 every night, etc., etc., I seemed to take to it as a fish to water, and I was very, very happy in the whole thing. And I chose at Sandhurst to go Indian Army for the one and only reason that back in my childhood proper, and living in Staple Grove, I had an introduction to horses via the local squire, and it would appear that I have a natural aptitude with animals, because that became apparent at a later stage, and my service career seems to be dominated by those words: he has a natural aptitude with animals. And so I had the good luck, if you will, to make the correct choice first time, i.e. the Indian Army, ex Sandhurst, and I was commissioned here in the UK and sent out as a lieutenant. 2 pips, by the way, full lieutenant. and my career started then, if you like, 1933.
How did you find soldiering in India?
Again, I was very lucky, perchance, but talking truthfully, I took to it again as the old duck to water. I liked all things that where a mess was involved, and had a super colonel in my first ever outfit, 9th Cavalry, Pune, who indoctrinated all of us by sending us out into the jungle with a bunch of Indian soldiers, ex-Indian origin, and or, in my case, Gurkha soldiers. And we were, so to speak, in his words, Indianized at an early date. And I seemed to respond to that treatment, liked it. And I never had any doubts whatsoever all the way through, but that I had made the correct choice initially, and I was enjoying my then present life also.
What were you doing when war broke out?
I was in a school of equitation, heading up, by the way, the school, in a place called Lansdowne, United Provinces. Lansdowne, by the way, being reminiscent for me because I had come from the West Country here, and near to Bristol, as you'll know, is a district known as Lansdowne. It includes a race course known as Bath Race Course. And I was very happy there, and I was in my element.
Did it surprise you when war broke out?
Yes. Surprise in the sense that prior to 1939, we had had no indication of the imminence of war, except, of course, by UK newspapers and, of course, the radio. But we weren't put on a war footing at all pre-1939. And indeed, we weren't ready at the war footing proper until end of 1940, early 41, to be precise, so that India did not know. You put it this way, the UK had already suffered all problems relating to German bombing and etc., and had gone through all the initial problems connected with a major war, and at which time we didn't even have, in India proper, any form of lack of food or supplies or blackouts or anything. Unknown quantity.
Did the outbreak of war create much of a stir amongst the actual Indian population?
No, sir, not as such. Not as one could tell, anyway, as such. I had meanwhile been indoctrinated into the Urdu language, which was the dominant language, of course, for all Indian regiments. And insofar as I could tell then, no, it mattered little or nothing. It simply was that our everyday way of life, maneuvers and the like, were now, as it were, being hotted up. And we only knew, and they only knew, of the imminence of war, in that we were now not pretending to cross a river, but actually crossing it. So the soldier began to rough it, so to speak, much more as you went into the end of 40 and early 41 than he had hitherto.
How did you first come to be connected with mules?
Well, I had had this animal thing back at home by hunters in the local village, and seemed to have this alleged natural aptitude with animals. But on going to India, and I went there expressly for that purpose, because the British Army were now running down all cavalry units at that time. Tanks were the in thing and the coming thing in the British Army and the British Army way of life. India wasn't, and India knew it couldn't be. And India represented for me the possibility of a continuity into horses and donkeys and ponies and mules that I wouldn't get elsewhere. And to do all this, I was sent to Jalandhar, up in the Punjab, where there were driver training regiments. And my function was, as a young subaltern, or captain I probably was then, my function was to be taught, so to speak, by the senior people, and then in turn to teach myself incoming new intakes of the Gurkha soldier and, of course, all various elements of the Indian Army soldiery, Madrasis, Punjabis and the like.
What do you remember about the outbreak of war with Japan in December 41, and the effect that had in India?
Not very much, except that Tokyo Rose came over on the radio, and we were, so to speak, conditioned into the effects of the Japanese soldier calling every British or other soldier Johnny and introducing himself by the English language Johnny. But I remember nothing untoward save that Pearl Harbor was coming, in that the influx, if you like, of American personnel was beginning. It hadn't yet come, but it was beginning. And as a British officer in India, be it British Army or Indian Army, one lost one's bearer, or in my case, orderly, all too readily, because the American soldier would come and pay twice or three times the premium to sneak him, so to speak. Head count, if you will. And so the American soldier came to India initially and wasn't terribly well received by UK personnel.
You mentioned Tokyo Rose. Did you listen to her frequently?
Not frequently, but inevitably. She came over in the radio in the mess, and indeed the colonel required it so, because there was a feeling of, so to speak, one perhaps can learn, you know, what is likely to happen to us at a later stage. Because we were static, you see. Jalandhar is just a small place in the northern Punjab area. It had little or nothing to offer, and except that radio comment about, relating to the outside world gave automatically this sort of feeling that, look out, chaps, we're for the high jump soon.
So you were encouraged by the colonel to listen to Tokyo Rose?
Not specifically in those words, but were allowed, I would say, rather than encouraged, allowed to. And one liked to be allowed to, because one learned. One felt one learned.
What type of things did you learn from listening to her?
Well, disposition of troops. What was happening in the outside world when we were in the very small enclave of Jalandhar? The big outside world was going on. We knew little or nothing about it. Newspapers came to us days, weeks indeed, often late. And anyway, when they came, they often were such that we had little or no time to read the newspapers. Radio was a shortcut to what we're now talking.
Did you think that what she said was reliable?
Not really. Not really, no. Any more than perhaps, you know, home here, you know, the German fellow, what was his name?
Lord
Haw Haw. Not Lord Haw Haw, was it? Just, anyway, whomever he was, credence wasn't necessarily given to him either. No, it was almost, you know, a something to do, would be the better way to put it.
But did people mock Tokyo Rose?
No, I don't think so, as such, but didn't give full credence to all that was said. That was the thing.
Were the
One always hoped that through transmissions that way one could learn, because we knew for sure that something was going to happen sooner or later, and for our part it did. But we were late off the mark in India, as opposed to what we knew was happening here in the UK.
Were the programs entertaining?
Again, not really, because one only concerned with the words as given, as opposed to any other part. Not necessarily, no. It was a something to do.
In 1942, there was the so-called Quit India movement, launched by the Congress Party. Did you personally come into contact with that?
No, sir. Nor did it, as far as I know, come anywhere near or into regimental areas at all. We had nothing. The whole back, if you like, to basics with the colonel not allowing religion or politics to be talked of in the mess. Additional to that was one's feeling also of not wanting so to do. So that, no, references to that were not dominant in my area, and I suspect everyone likewise.
So you weren't aware of any disturbances in your part of the Punjab?
No, truthfully not, no. That is to say, not until the after event and the net result of such and such a happening, no.
Your unit was called number 1 DIR?
DTR, Driver Training Regiment. And there was number 2 Driver Training Regiment as well.
How did you come to be in the Chindits?
Well, I had... I never volunteered, by the way. One doesn't. One shouldn't. I came into the Chindits because I had this alleged ability with animals, as the army term is, namely the everyday requirement of the horse and the donkey and the pony and the mule. And I had also knew something about aircraft. And General Wingate had decreed that after the first expedition, 42, he would, at this later stage, mount a major assault, hopefully, because he had the guidance and the goodwill of Lord Louis Mountbatten and Sir Winston Churchill and others home here as well. Importantly, that he wanted to lay on a major scheme. And regarding me personally, my experience was such that I might be a useful chap knowing something about the inside of an airplane and knowing something about training for horses and donkeys and ponies and mules and the men that went with it. And in consequence, the two together may make me a reasonable chap, said someone somewhere at GHQ Delhi. I was therefore posted. I didn't volunteer. I was posted and became Brigade Animal Transport Officer, 111 Brigade Special Force, as it was then called, before they concocted the word Chindit. And that came later. But 111 Brigade Special Force, and I was sent there.
When would this have been about?
Something like middle of 42.
Where did you go to, and what was the setup when you got there?
Dukwan Dam, the actual area was. And in the area of Dukwan, there were big, huge tracks of jungle, as well as Maidan, open areas, for the purposes of bulk training, brigade strength, for instance. And this lent itself to exactly what General Wingate aspired to, namely the bringing up of brigades to a competent strength that they badly wanted if he was to be able to go in to Burma proper, that is, and take on the Japanese, who at this particular time, 1942 and thereabouts, was totally numerically outnumbered all other people in the area, including even the Burmese people themselves. They had infiltrated Burma proper and had total and complete control. The Japanese soldier, therefore, was alleged at that side to be, at that time, rather, to be invincible. And General Wingate had it that if he could only train troops who could maneuver, if you will, soldier in monsoon conditions, which hitherto had not been known properly either, and have a real pucker background of strength, this Japanese soldier was not the invincible soldier he was alleged to be. All of this was music in the ear of Lord Louis Mountbatten, El Supremo as he was at that time, Southeast Asia Command. It was also the known fact of Field Marshal Sir William Slim, who, by the way, was a Bristol man. I didn't know it then, but I know it now. He led his 14th Army, and indeed the poor 14th Army were called the, inverted commas, Forgotten Army. And so you can see morale, British Army-wise, was very, very low. The Indian Army counted for little, much less, being all that numerically infinitely smaller and of no special consequence. And so General Wingate really started at basics, and he had to convince his superiors as to the possibility of all this, and he fortunately acquired in the process thereof the strength of Field Marshal Sir William Slim, who visited us, by the way, when we were on maneuvers and thought well of us, and who in turn was directly involved, of course, with Lord Louis as our chief. And he, Lord Louis Mountbatten, visited us likewise, and he liked what he saw, and he must inevitably have been happy with it all, in that he supported all endeavors by General Wingate to mount what we now call the Tindit operations in Burma, but which were then called Special Force.
Were you impressed with 111 Brigade when you got to Dakwa?
Very much so, sir, yes. Because, you see, the brigadier then, Brigadier Joe Lentaine, DSO, a big, tall Irishman, seemed to be about 10 foot tall, but I believe he was 6 foot six. He was a fine figure of a man and a fine disposition too. He had a brigade major, Jack Masters, as we then called him, who later became Colonel John Masters, DSO, the author of many books on India and likewise. And this brigade major and Joe Lentaine together worked extremely well together. Their origin were a Gurkha regiment. I believe I remember 3rd, 4th. And we had elements in my outfit of the 3rd, 4th, and the 4th, 9th Gurkha battalions. And so those two ran a good ship. And I was, so to speak, we all were, chaps like me were specialists in one field only. My one field was the animal side of it. And General Wingate could not mount operations into Burma through Brigadier Lentaine without the mule. The mule was the whole key to everything. And by virtue of that, General Wingate had to have what he called specialist people. I was such, for want of other words to use, in relation to the mule, and I was posted to 111 Brigade, liked it very, very much, got on extremely well with everyone, and my function now, from now on, was to take elements out of British Army personnel, as well as the Gurkha personnel, and train them and to, so to speak, look after and care for the mule. Most of them were non-mule types, particularly British troops. But one gave a mule to a man, and that became his responsibility. And my job was to cultivate, so to speak, the spirit as between the mule driver and the mule, and it worked.
What were the main problems of looking after the mules?
A number, main of which, no British other rank had ever hardly seen a mule, let alone handled one, number one. Number two was the question of affinity as between the mule and the man. Some of our chaps were even afraid of the mule, not because, you know, the obvious kick. Others didn't like the having to groom, because on maneuvers we groomed, though when we went into the jungle, of course, all such niceties were dropped. But in training, to get the man near his mule, he was forced, made, and cultivated, if you will, encouraged to groom. And that brought him near the animal, physically, and better. But there was never any, or rarely was there any background as between the man and the mule. They were diverse. They were opposites. They were away from each other. But suddenly they were given one. And my job was now to encourage a hoped-for affinity that they could name the mule Fred or Jack or Tom, whatever, and from then onwards that was your responsibility, or else. And one put a wee bit of disciplined pressure in the words, but that is all. And it out of that grew what became a very successful, later, column procedure, because General Wingate divided all his brigades down into columns, a column being a length of perhaps half a mile of men walking single file with their mules, but interdependent, the column, self-dependent, sorry, and a little army of its own.
Are mules easy to look after?
Yes, sir, given the right spirit in the initial instance, so to do. The hoped-for thing, which is acquired and can be acquired with a disciplined approach and the correct approach, you see, there was nothing about a mule or a horse or a pony or a donkey that I myself could not do. So I set an example, and that was where perhaps such successes we attained came that way. I would do everything and anything. What is more, in the event of a man having a problem with a mule, his main function now, his orders indeed, were to stand on one side, thus not to impede the column, until I came up and I would put the thing right, whatever that was. It was usually a simple thing, like a load that the mule was carrying had slipped. The surcingle that held it all intact was probably not correctly put on in the initial instance, or the girth straps had broken, whatever. My function now was to put it right, tell him what was wrong so he'd know him.